Okay, so maybe we can start this evening's talk. So for tonight, I'm going to talk about freedom of the will, freedom of choice, and these kind of issues, and see where that gets us, because it is one of those things that I think is very, very important in our modern society, this idea of freedom of choice and freedom of will. And of course, we can. I'll talk about in a second why that is the case. But of course, the idea of freedom is also very fundamental and very important part of the Buddhist teachings. But the idea in Buddhist teachings is slightly different. Whereas in the worldly sense, it is freedom of choice, the ability to do what you want, that is important. In Buddhism, the idea of freedom is more the idea of freedom from suffering, the freedom from an affliction, the freedom from a problem. So how do these things actually relate to each other? What is the connection between freedom of will, if you like, or the will, and freedom from suffering or freedom from problems in life? These are some of the things I would like to have a look at tonight. First of all, just to talk a little bit about why this idea of freedom of choice is considered so important. And of course, one of the reasons is that we think that if we have freedom of choice, then we have the ability to move towards happiness and move away from suffering. That is a very large part of what freedom of choice is all about, right? This ability to make ourselves happy. What does it say again in the American Constitution? Something about the pursuit of happiness, right? The pursuit of happiness is like the freedom of choice. It's almost the kind of epitome of what we mean by freedom of choice in life, the pursuit of happiness in the world. And that is, of course, we can see why that is important. But of course, from a Buddhist point of view, there is something very problematic with that. And that is to be able to choose happiness, to be able to choose in the right direction, to choose what is good for us. First of all, we have to know what happiness actually is. We have to know where happiness lies, right? If you don't understand where happiness is, if we are deluded in a certain way, if we have wrong view about reality and things, then freedom of choice isn't going to be all that helpful. It is more like a freedom to choose silly things often, rather than actually freedom to really go in any particularly good direction. So you can see there straight away from a Buddhist idea, Buddhist point of view, the idea of freedom of choice is often fundamentally flawed because we don't really know what we are choosing or where we're heading with that particular choice. So that is one aspect of freedom of choice, right? The other aspect, which is very important with free will and free choice, is the sense that we are exerting our personality, we're exercising our personality in a certain way. Right? The idea we all identify to some extent with the doer inside of us, with the agency, with the fact that we will, the fact that we choose. And because we identify with that, because we take that to be a core aspect of who we are, it means that when we make choices, we are exercising ourselves. We are kind of allowing our sense of who we are to exist in the world, to do what it has to do, and we feel alive because of that. We feel that our sense of self is satisfied because we're exercising it in a certain way. And you can see why that is very attractive, right? The identity actually is being exercised in a certain way. But what is interesting, again, from a Buddhist point of view, just straight away to see how it compares with Buddhist ideas, is that you notice in meditation practice, when you become peaceful, when you become calm, when the will is not exercised, right? When that sense of identity with who you are in terms of will and choice, when that starts to calm down, you actually feel better, right? It actually feels nice to be peaceful. All this idea of willing and choosing, you start to realize actually it's a pain, it's a problematic thing. And this is kind of getting to very much a core aspect of what the Buddhist teaching is about, right? We identify with something, and that something that we identify is actually problematic. It is actually a degree of suffering to the very things that we identify with, the very things we take to be ourselves. Right? So again, you can see why these two things, which I think are very important aspects of choice and will and these things, actually, from a Buddhist point of view, they don't really stack up. So what is the Buddhist idea of choice and will? How can we look at that in a fairly, how important is it from a Buddhist point of view? And of course, first of all, we know that it must be very important. It is important if you look basically at the laws of karma. The idea of karma is that every time you choose, it will have an effect, right? Our intentions in the world will leave an imprint on our mind. And we know that already. You can see that in yourself so easily. When you do an act of kindness, you tend to feel good afterwards. Your intention, your choice, has a direct effect on yourself. You do an act which is not so kind, it also has an effect on you, because you feel bad about yourself afterwards. So from that level alone, we know that, of course, choice and intention actually is fundamental also in the Buddhist practice. But to show you this from a slightly different angle, I will tell you, this is a small little story from the suttas, from the word of the Buddha. I always like to bring in the word of the Buddha if I have a chance in any talk I give anywhere on this planet, which is because it is so nice to get it from the master himself. And sometimes it is so much more profound, right, when you hear it directly from the Buddha. I know a lot of people really enjoy hearing those particular teachings. And this is a teaching from the Ratapala Sutta. If you want to look it up yourself, it's in the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, number 82. It's a very touching and beautiful story about a young man who was very, very keen on going forth and becoming a monastic in the Buddha's dispensation. In fact, he was so keen that he's told his parents, I want to go forth. And when his parents said, no way, we don't allow you to go forth, absolutely no chance, he said, okay, I will lie down on the ground right here. Either you will allow me to go forth or I will die right here. That's how keen he was, right? So very, very keen. So it's a very nice story. And actually, somebody I was meeting today, there was somebody who said they wanted to become a monk at Bodhinala Monastery. And I asked him, when are you going to come? And he said, well, my parents are a bit difficult. They're not so keen on me becoming a monk. But he said, but if all else fails, I will do the Ratapala strategy, he said. I will lie down on the ground and say, either I die here or I will go forth. It's beautiful. It's kind of inspiring. You understand that there's something very important going on here, so much so that you're willing to risk your life to be able to go forth. And of course, later on, I'm not going to tell the whole story this time because it's a long, but very nice story. He goes forth. Eventually, his parents give in, of course. He attains arahantship and he becomes fully awakened. Afterwards, he comes back to his parents. He has a very interesting exchange with his parents, right? His parents are not really ready to accept that he's an arahant, so they try to lure him back to lay life, unsuccessfully, of course. And then eventually, at the very last part of this story, he meets a king, and he has a conversation with his king. And this king was known as Kauravya. And the conversation is basically as follows. The king comes to meet Ratapala, and he looks at Ratapala. The king is already really old, and Ratapala is a really young man, right? So the king looks at him and says, well, you are a young man in the prime of life, right? Still with black hair. This is in India. People have black hair before it becomes gray. So black hair in the prime of life. You came from a good family that had a lot of wealth. You had a wife. You had a good education. You had everything. How come you have gone forth? Right? You must be nuts. Okay, if you are old, I can understand why you might go forth. If you're sick, if you haven't got any money or food, right? Okay, then I can understand why you might go forth. But not if you have all of those things. Right? In India, the idea was that when you got old, then you kind of went forth into the ascetic life. But as Buddhists, it was different. People went forth even when they were young, right? Like Venerable Sunya here, still in his 20s, is that right? Still in his 20s?
Just 30.
Just 30, okay, just become 30. Okay, good. So still when you're young, right, you go forth. So he asks him, what is it that you have seen? What is it that you have understood that made you go forth while you still had everything in life? This should be impossible. I don't get it. And then Ratapala, he tells this king four summaries of the Dhamma, four summaries of the Buddha's teachings. He tells the king, when I understood, when I saw those four summaries of the Buddha's teachings, that is when I decided to go forth and become a monastic. And one of those summaries is that The Buddha says that there is no shelter, there is no protector, there is no overlord in the world. Right? There is no shelter, there is no protector, there is no overlord in the world. One of the Pali words here is abhisara, and abhisara means like God, right? A lord in the sense of a god, somebody who kind of stands above you and protects you. When I use the word God here, I don't just mean the God in the sense of kind of Western ideas of God, of a Christian God. I also mean ideas like the Hindu ideas, where you have your own personal God who looks after you, right? Krishna, or Vishnu, or Shiva, or Kali, or something like that, right? Who looks after you. This is what I also mean here by protector. The Buddha says there is no protector in the world. There is nobody there to look after you, right? And it's a very powerful statement when you think about it. The vast majority of people who are religious in the world, including the Buddhists, believe that there are powers out there that can protect you. There are beings, there are protectors, like gods or whatever. Gods, big gods, small gods, gods of whatever kind, who can look after you in a certain way. And here the Buddha says, no, there is no such protection to be found in the world. There is no such thing that will come there and look after you in this way. And of course, if you're used to thinking about a God looking after you, it's kind of scary, right? It's very useful to have a God, somebody who was there, make sure that you're always safe, you don't go the wrong way, if you make a misstep, you could go this way, and if you have a really bad life, well, at least if you believe in the end, you go to heaven, right? It's kind of handy to have somebody there who makes the final decisions, who have the final responsibility for the world and where the world is going, and where you are going personally as well. But at the same time, it's also a little bit scary, right? Because a God is there. If the God has final responsibility, it's like you're laying your life into the hands of something unknown. What if this unknown capacity, call it a God, call it whatever you like, what if that unknown capacity has the wrong ideas? Or even worse, what if that unknown capacity doesn't exist in the first place? You're believing in some kind of fairy which isn't actually there. What then? Then, of course, you have a very serious problem. So although it can be scary to move away from this idea of being protected in the world, once you move away from that, what happens is that you start to take full responsibility for your own life. You are no longer allowing something outside of you to take that responsibility. You take that responsibility yourself instead. Right? And actually, when you do that, when you move away from this idea of an external protector and you start to look after yourself and to protect yourself, it is actually very empowering. Because it means that whether you experience happiness or suffering in the world, that is not up to some external protector, some external shelter. It is up to you. You are in charge of the happiness or suffering in your own life. Right? It is actually very empowering. So you move like from a stage where perhaps you believe in the protection of external forces, you feel it's a bit scary to give it up, but when you actually give that up and you take full responsibility for your own life, it is extraordinarily empowering instead. You are in charge. You make the difference. Nothing outside of you really has that ability to make a difference in your life. So what that means in terms of choice and freedom of will, we're talking about the freedom of will here and freedom of choice. What it means for that is that every choice we make matters, right? Every time you make a decision, that decision will either be for your benefit or for your detriment. Nobody outside of you is going to save you and say, well, okay, you made a mistake, but anyway, I'll sort it out for you. It doesn't work like that in Buddhism. If you make a mistake, you're going to have to bear the consequences. If you do something right, you also get the consequences. Every choice we make, every time we will something, every time we make a decision in our life, it will have an effect on our future, on our suffering and our happiness. So what that means is that from a Buddhist point of view, choice, will, decision is actually extremely important, right? It's fundamental to the entire Buddhist path. If we will in the right way, we will be heading in the right direction. If we will in the wrong way, we will going in the wrong direction and have to experience the negative results of that. So in a way, you could argue that of all, perhaps, religions in the world, of all of these different teachings, it is arguable that in Buddhism, the will is actually the most important in the Buddhist teaching, more so than perhaps anywhere else. So it is fundamental. And of course, this fact, if you like, that will or choice is so important in Buddhism, this is very interesting when you start to look at things like, is there such a thing as free will? Right? The idea of whether there is free will or not is one of these ancient conundrums that philosophers have been arguing about since time immemorial, at least in the West. It hasn't been such a big kind of issue in Eastern religions, but certainly in Western philosophy has been a very important part of philosophy. So is there free will, right? Are we ultimate masters of ourselves? Are we really independent of external phenomena? Are we able to make choices without being too influenced by worldly phenomena and things outside of us? This is really the idea of free will, this idea of independence of choice, choice that stands apart from the rest of the world, so we can actually exercise that will at our own discretion, if you like. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, that whole idea of complete freedom of the will, of being completely independent will-wise, doesn't really make all that much sense, right? And I think that intuitively we know that in our lives as well, that the idea of freedom of will can be no such thing as an absolute freedom of will. You know that because you can see how conditioned your own will is. When you make choices in life, where do those choices come from? If you are grown up in a certain way, used to eating certain foods, used to wearing certain clothes, used to a certain climate, right? Used to a certain way of living, used to certain entertainments, whatever it is, we get used to things. And when we are used to things, we tend to make our choices in accordance to what we are used to. I'm sure you can all see that, right? You have your favorite foods or whatever it is. Choice is incredibly conditioned, right? And that is just the beginning, of course. That's just in a very superficial way of understanding how conditioned choice is. It actually goes much more profoundly than that. The Buddhist teaching says that choice is conditioned. That is very clear from such important suttas as the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the qualities of non-self, right? But also, it is very much an important aspect of our own experience as well. The only question really is, how far does it actually go? To what extent is that choice conditioned? To what extent is our will not really free at all? That is really the only question. And to me, when I look at that question, I cannot really see any other way except that the will is completely conditioned. As far as I'm concerned, there cannot be any free will in this world. And why is that? Because all the things, all the inputs, if you like, that go into a choice, all those inputs, right, they are themselves conditioned by other things in turn. And all of these conditioned phenomena, they go into that choice, and then the choice is made on the basis of all these other conditioned phenomena, which are all dependent on other things in return. So how can there be any independence in that kind of system? It's just conditioned phenomena, dependent phenomena, building on other dependent phenomena, on and on and on and on. And I personally, philosophically, cannot see how there is any room for freedom of choice in that particular system, in the way the world actually works. There are people who will disagree with that. There are Buddhist people who will say that that is not the case, that there is such a thing as freedom of choice. But even those who disagree with that, they will say that the scope of freedom is very, very small, right? Maybe there is a little bit of freedom there, but of course the vast majority of what we do is very strongly conditioned. The vast majority of choices still have a very strong conditioning aspect to them. So regardless of how we look at this, conditioning of choice is very, very strong and very important. And this has some very important consequences, right? If our will is not all that free, if our will is conditioned by all of these other phenomena, it has some very powerful consequences. And one of those consequences is that when We look at people in the world, we look at ourselves, and we see people sometimes doing bad things, right? It can help us with how we react to other people doing bad things. When we understand that whatever negative thing happens in the world, whatever negative choices are made, it happens because of conditioning. Once we start to understand that, once we understand the depth of that, it becomes quite easy to forgive and also to let go of what is happening. Right? And the reason why that is the case is because if somebody is completely conditioned, if the choices, if they do something bad, doesn't really come from themselves, if it isn't their own choice, it means that in a sense they are prisoners of their own conditioning. Right? The reason why somebody may say something bad to you or even think something bad is not because they want to think something bad, but it's because the conditioning from the past is so powerful and so pervasive and so strong that they don't really have a choice. Maybe they want to be kind to you. Maybe they really want to say something nice. But the conditioning from the past and causes them to actually say something which is unkind instead. They are prisoners of their own personality, prisoners of their own conditioning. And we are all like that to some extent, right? We all know sometimes we lose our temper. And it's not because we want to lose our temper, it's because we can't help ourselves. We know that it would be much better to be kind and to be caring, to be compassionate, because we know that that leads to our own happiness and also the happiness of others. But we can't stop because the conditioning is so strong. This is one of the benefits of understanding the power of the conditioning of choice and the power of the conditioning of the will. Because once you understand that, you can start to forgive, you can start to let go, because you understand that other people are not really capable of doing anything apart from what they're doing. And the Buddha talks about this in the suttas. There's a beautiful simile in the suttas that describes this in a very nice way. And this is the simile where the Buddha says, it's just like a sick person, a person who is gravely ill, walking along the road, right? And while they're walking along the road, this is like a deserted road. There's no people around, there's no village or nobody living there, there's no houses there. And of course, because there are no people around, there is no medicine, right? There's nobody to look after them, there's no nurse, there's no doctor. So if you are gravely ill, walking along in the wilderness on a deserted road like that, with nobody to help you, what is your destiny? Your destiny is pretty miserable, right? It's going to get worse and worse for you. You are essentially either going to get really, really ill, or most likely you're going to die if that illness is very severe and very bad. What happens if you see this man walking along on this road? What happens is that, of course, what you do is you give rise to a sense of sympathy and compassion for that man. Why is that? Because you realize here who is somebody is sick for no fault of their own, and they are moving towards a really bad destiny, a very bad future, probably dying as a consequence. And when you see that, how do you feel about that person? Sympathy, compassion, a sense of concern, a sense of care, a sense of wanting to do something to be able to help that individual. And the Buddha says it is exactly the same when somebody does something bad in this world, right? When somebody does something bad, if somebody has a bad personality, they habitually do bad things, you should look upon them as if they are a sick person. Why is that? Because they are acting for their own misery in the future. Anybody who lives in a bad way and does bad things, what they are really doing is that they are acting in a way which will cause their own suffering in the future. Nobody wants to create suffering for themselves. And the only reason why you would do that is because you are deluded. Because you don't really understand the reality of what you're doing. You think that by doing bad things or saying the wrong thing, you will create happiness. Or, as I said before, your conditioning from the past is so powerful and so strong that you can't help yourself but do the bad things. Of course, in that case, you are just deluded. You don't know what you're doing. You're like a sick person because you are making bad decisions for yourself that have a far worse effect for yourself in the future than it has on anyone who has to take the brunt of those actions, whatever it is that you do. So think about that. You know, whenever anyone talks to you in a bad way or does something to you in a bad way, does something which isn't nice, remember that they are the one who has a problem. They are the one who is deluded. They are the one who can't see clearly. They are the one who don't understand where true happiness lies, right? And when you think like that, you realize that somebody doing something bad to you is not personal at all. It is only that person playing out those conditions that have worked on them for a long, long, long time in the past. And they are playing out in the present moment. They can't really stop it. They may want to be kind, they may want to do the nice thing, but they can't stop themselves from doing those bad things. And when you look at it like that, it is very hard not to have compassion for that person, a sense of goodwill towards them, because you know that they're not coming from a sense of free will, not coming from a sense of freedom of choice. They're coming from, instead, conditioning in the past. So this is the first consequence of this lack of an absolute free will, right? I would say a completely unfree will, a lack of freedom of choice. But there's another consequence, which in many ways is perhaps even more profound. And this, of course, has to do with our own personal practice. Because not just other people who lack a sense of freedom of choice, it is exactly the same thing for us. So if our choices are so strongly conditioned, how can we ensure that we practice in the right way? How can we ensure that we actually follow a teaching, philosophy, whatever it is, that leads to our own happiness and leads away from suffering? How can we ensure that? And of course, what you will understand very quickly is that the only way to ensure that is that you get conditioned by something which actually will aid you in that direction. If you get conditioned by the right things, then, of course, the choices that you make will be right. And you can see that if you look at the Noble Eightfold Path. For maybe some of you are new to this, but if you think about the Noble Eightfold Path, it starts off with right view. Right view is number one. From that right view, you get the second factor. The second factor is often called right intention, samma sankappa in Pali. But really, what that second factor refers to is not so much intention as such, but the right aim, what you're aiming for in the future, right purpose, if you like. In other words, where you're heading. It is very similar to right choice, right? If you have the right aim, if you have the right purpose, you will tend to make the right choices as a consequence. So you can see here, it comes from the idea of right view. Once you have right view, once the delusion in the mind is decreased and become less, then you start to have the right aim in life. Then you start to think in a straight way, and you start doing those things that actually will lead towards your happiness and away from your suffering. And that right view, where does that come from? It comes from what in the suttas is called the eye of the world. The eye of the world was just another name or a word for the Buddha. The Buddha is the one who awakens to the truth, and once the Buddha has awakened to the truth, seen reality as it actually is, he passes it on to others, and that is why he's called the eye of the world. So that is where we go, right? That is where that right view is found. That is where the conditioning is found. So again, it's something that I've been talking about a lot recently, that I think is so fundamental on the Buddhist path, is to remind ourselves all the time what the spiritual practice really is, to get that spiritual input, right, from good teachings that align with the way the Buddha taught, often, ideally, the word of the Buddha himself. But if we can't do that, at least some other teachings that align with that, that go in the same direction. And from that, just by doing that much, your choices start to become right. You start to choose in a way which leads you in the right direction, because your choices are conditioned by something which actually works, something useful, straight view, insight, understanding things in the right way. Right? So these are this again arises from the idea of a lack of free will, a lack of freedom of choice, the importance of conditioning ourselves in the right way. Brainwashing, if you like, right? Brainwashing often has a bad name, but in Buddhism it has a really good name. In Buddhism, brainwashing is really, really good. It sounds bad, but when you understand that, that is really what conditioning is all about. Conditioning is really just about that, right? We are kind of conditioning ourselves. It is a kind of brainwashing. So make sure you get the right kind of brainwashing, and then you're in business, you're heading in the right direction. So that these are two of the consequences of a lack of free will. But there is one thing I also would like to warn you against. There's also a danger of the lack of free will. When we think about that, sometimes we think that, oh yeah, there's no free will, so I can, you know, I can just kind of, one of the thoughts is that, yeah, I can just kind of chill all day, just lie in bed, do nothing, right? There's no free will anyway, so no need to do anything. And that is taking it completely the wrong way. Because there may not be any free will, but just because the will isn't free doesn't mean the will doesn't matter. The will still matters, right? Choice matters. It still matters that we make the right choices. It's just that getting there is not a matter of freedom. It's a matter of conditioning. So this is the first thing. But the other thing which is dangerous when people sometimes think that there is no free will, they sometimes think that, well, if there is no free will, it means that, you know, I don't really have to will anything in the world. I don't really have to do anything. All I have to do is kind of allow myself, you know, do what other people say I should do, and then not really kind of take any responsibility because I just go with the flow, so to speak. But there is a certain danger in that. There's a danger in not feeling that you are willing in your own life. Because a very important part of having a sense of, we all have a sense that we have freedom of will, right? It may not, logically, may not be correct. Once we start to investigate it, we may find out that there are great limitations on the freedom of the will. But still, there is a sense inside of us that we have that freedom. And that sense inside of us that we have that freedom must be honored to a certain extent. If we suppress that sense inside of us, very often what happens is that we can very easily become depressed, right? I think this is one of the great causes of depression in the world, is the sense that we are not really masters of ourselves, we're not in charge of our lives. All the conditions and phenomena around us conspire against us, and they cause us to suffer, and there's nothing we can do about that. And that often leads to a feeling of depression, that we have no say in how our lives actually unfold. So that is also the wrong takeaway from the message of no free will. It is not that we just allow ourselves to be bossed around by others or bossed around by the world. That is also wrong. In fact, what we really should be doing is we should actually take the sense of self that we have, this feeling inside of us that we have choice, we should use that, and we should use that to our benefit in the right way. So one way of using this feeling of choice is to say, yeah, I want to do whatever I want in the world. I want to go out to do bad things when I want to do bad things, and to do good things when I want to do good things. I want to mess around and do whatever I really want. This is one idea of freedom of choice and how to exercise the freedom that we have, we feel that we have inside of us. But that is not a good way. What we should instead try to do is to co-opt, to use this sense of freedom that we have inside of us, to use that, to enhance it, so to enhance our practice of the spiritual path, right? That is how we should use it. So when we realize that our mind is defiled, for example, we realize that we're about to break certain precepts, we realize that we are about to do something immoral, whatever that is when we should exercise our freedom of choice to instead move in a different direction, move in a direction towards morality, towards goodness, towards the practice of the Buddhist path. Right? So instead of allowing the freedom of choice to be a negative, to be a drag on our lives, we elevate it to something positive so we can make positive choices in our existence. We co-opt that freedom of choice that we feel we have to enhance the movement forwards on the spiritual path. And if we do that, then I think we are using the sense of freedom that we have inside of us, that we feel we have inside of us, in a positive way to help us move in the right direction. So don't allow this to be a cause for depression, because sometimes it can be. That would be terrible, wouldn't it, if we got depressed because there is so perhaps no free will, and it would be really counterproductive. But there is a completely different idea. This is more like a Buddhist idea, and it's also an idea that you sometimes can see in philosophy. There's a completely different way of looking at this idea of free will. One way of looking at free will, as I said, is to think that the will is somehow independent, that it stands apart, and it has the ability to choose freely in the world. But there is another idea of free will, and this is really what the Buddhist idea of free will is all about. And that is, instead of independence, it is a freedom from constraints. Right? So what do we mean by freedom of constraints? And the problem is that in our lives we are constrained by so many things, right? From a Buddhist point of view, one of the most important constraints is delusion, our lack of seeing things clearly. Because we can't see things clearly, our mind is constrained to that area of darkness where we are. Outside that area of darkness, we cannot make any choices, right? It's impossible. And our life is full of these kind of constraints. Another very important constraint in life is craving. Craving is always in charge. Craving says you can choose A or you can choose B, right? But we are constrained by the craving. We cannot say no to the craving itself. We either follow craving this way or we follow craving that way. So, and this can be seen quite easily also in some of the other similes that the Buddha uses in the suttas. I was just mentioning before the Ratapala Sutta of the young man who went forth and said, I'm either going to go forth or die right here. One of the other teachings that he gives to that king is that we are a slave to craving, right? Craving is in charge. We are following along. We are being driven by craving, restlessly moving on and on in our lives without any end in sight. Slaves to craving, that is what we are. And of course, if you are a slave, what does that mean? Well, sometimes it may mean that like you have a rope around your neck, right? You have a rope around your neck, and then the slave owner says, do this, do that. And so we, in many ways, that is exactly what we are when we are following along craving. And the choices that we have as slaves in this particular case, if we have a rope around our neck, the rope in this case is a reference to the craving, dragging us this way, dragging us that way. The choices we have is like what kind of rope we can have, right? You can have a hemp rope, a cotton rope, a rope. You can choose the color of the rope that you have around your neck, right? It doesn't really make much difference, right? You still have a rope around your neck. And that is what it means. You are a slave to craving. Yes, you have choices. You can choose A or B. You can choose the kind of rope you have, what color it is. But still, you are a slave. Still, you are being kind of half, you can barely breathe because of that rope around your neck. So the problem is still there. And that shows you in a very beautiful way how it is that we are constrained by defilements, by problems in our mind, by the lack of ability of seeing things clearly. Anger is another such constraint, right? All these defilements, the habits from the past, they narrow us down and narrow down the choices that we can actually make in life. Another nice simile that you may have heard here before, which Ajahn Brahm sometimes uses, is the simile of being in prison. Right? We are imprisoned. Again, we are imprisoned by all of these defilements, especially by the delusion, by not seeing clearly. We are imprisoned in the darkness. We cannot see what's really going on. So in that prison, you can choose the colors of the prison walls, right? You can choose the colors of the metal bars there. You can choose maybe what kind of bed you have in prison, what kind of food you have. But regardless of how many choices you make for that prison, it doesn't make any difference. You are still in prison. You still have a problem. You would like to be free, right? You're not really free here. And the ordinary choices of life, the choices, the freedom of choices that we make are precisely those kind of choices. We are in prison already. So what is the point of actually making these minor little adjustments? We are constrained in a very serious way, and this is the problem. So the Buddhist path then actually becomes a path of deconstraining ourselves, deconstraining the mind, right? Getting rid of these defilements, getting rid of the craving, getting rid of the anger, and finally, most important of all, getting rid of delusion and misunderstanding itself. If you are deluded, it's like you are in darkness. You don't really know where to go, and you walk at random around, going down the wrong path. And one day, somebody turns on the light, right? Now, for the first time, you can see where you should be going. You know what's going on. You can see the world around you. You know what is true and what isn't true. Now you can take the real path towards happiness. And this is the idea with reducing the constraints. The more you reduce the constraints of the mind, until eventually the mind is entirely free of those constraints. It is entirely pure. Then, for the first time, do you understand the distinction between real happiness and real suffering here? And of course, it is only when you understand the distinction between real happiness and suffering that you can make real choices. If you don't know what happiness is, if you're walking around in the dark, as I said a second ago, you're going to make all the wrong choices. You're going to keep on moving towards suffering all the time. When those constraints are taken away, when the mind sees clearly, this is what we mean by vipassana, by insight. This is what we mean by yatha bhuta nanadasana, seeing things according to reality. Now you can make the right choices in life. So the whole Buddhist path becomes this gradual elimination of the constraints on the mind, until one day the constraints are completely gone, right? And then you see things in accordance with reality. And the Buddha says, in another beautiful simile of his, some of the best similes in the suttas are the similes of mountains, because mountains are so majestic and magnificent. And this is a simile of two friends who walk up to this mountain, right? And then one friend says to the other one, I'm going to go to the top of the mountain. And the other friend says, I'll wait for you down here. So this friend, first friend, goes up to the top of the mountain. It's only a small mountain, right? They can still kind of shout to each other and hear each other. He goes to the top of the mountain and he shouts down to his friend and he says, wow, I can see so much from up here. I can see fields, I can see villages, rivers and roads, parks and all of these beautiful things out there. And the fellow on the bottom says, rubbish, you can't see any of those things. Right? Like most people don't really want to know what's going on in the world. We're complete nonsense, they won't have anything of that. And so this fellow on the top of the mountain gets a bit exasperated. I'm seeing it, for goodness sake, you're on the bottom. How can you say rubbish? So he goes down the mountain, goes down the bottom, grabs his friend by the arm, right, and pulls him up to the top. And he says to him, well, what do you see? Oh, I see villages, fields, roads, rivers, all those things. Just a second ago, you said it was rubbish. What are you talking about? Oh, just before, when I was standing at the bottom, I was hindered by this great mountain. The great mountain is a simile for the hindrances. It is a simile for the defilements, a simile for the obstructions in the mind. As long as the mountain is there, you cannot really see what is going on. You have to move to the top of the mountain. And when you get there, the top of the mountain is a simile for samadhi. It's a simile for deep meditation, when all the hindrances are abandoned. Only then can you understand. Only then can you see in accordance with reality. Only then can you make real choices in life that are going to be for your benefit and also for the benefit of everyone else. So this is the Buddhist idea of freedom, deconstraining your mind. And what is so paradoxical about this, and this is kind of the really weird thing, right? When you really deconstrain the mind and when you start to see things according to reality, that is when you understand that this idea that you had free will, it was an illusion all along. Right? So you see that this idea of free will actually was a hindrance. Free will was actually a problem. It was something that you imagined was there, but actually wasn't there in the first place. And when you see that there was no freedom of the will, or you realize that actually it lies in a completely different place, it is when you see that freedom of the will is a delusion, that is when you get true freedom. And that is when you get true freedom of choice, because now you can actually choose for your own benefit and for your own happiness, rather than choose all the wrong things. So by seeing that there is no freedom of will, that is how we get true freedom of choice in the Buddhist way. The freedom from constraints, the ability to see where real happiness lies and where suffering lies. And only then are we able to live our life to the fullest. So this is the Buddhist path, right? The gradual removal of those constraints. And as you do that, eventually you come to the top. Then you understand what it's all about. And the whole idea of freedom of the will falls away. It was irrelevant. It had nothing to do with the Buddhist teachings in the first place. That is what you realize at that point. Okay, so I'm not going to say anything more for tonight. Drew said I was going to talk for an hour, so I'm kind of shortchanging you a little bit there, but so be it, because I think it's good to stop at that particular point. Okay, so would anyone like to ask any questions about this or complain about anything or anything else? This is your opportunity to do that if you like. And nobody has any questions? Okay. Whoa! Oh, Eddie. Eddie always has something to say. Okay. Yes. Okay, good. Okay. Yeah.
Thought so. Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
I could hear you as
well.
I'd
like to share, you know,
yeah.
See, I'd like to say that as a Buddhist, yeah. I'm proud, you know, that I'm free, I have freedom to do what I want to do. Okay. Firstly, there's no external power or God to tell me, control me, yeah. or frighten me, to tell me what I can do and what I cannot do.
Okay, good, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Secondly, this thing is, okay, there's precepts which I follow, okay? The precepts are not commandments. They are not thou shall not, you know. The precepts is, I undertake the precept to do to my, the best of my ability.
Yeah.
So each time I keep improving myself, okay, yeah. And thirdly is, I follow and practice the Buddha's teaching, okay, yeah. Experienced this thing, and it has brought me a lot of happiness and peace.
Good, okay? Excellent.
And of course, there's problems too.
Wonderful.
The Buddha teaches me how to deal with them and get rid of them.
Great.
Fast.
Sadhu.
Freedom.
Well done. Yeah.
You know, as a Buddhist, I have a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
Good. Practice.
Yeah, great. No, that's excellent. That's always nice. Eddie has been a Buddhist pretty much all his life and always practicing well. So that's what a wonderful thing here. So. Yeah. Anyone else like to say anything here? Everybody else happy here? Okay. Everybody else really happy. So that's good. So okay. So let's take some couple of questions from overseas and also from Melbourne. There's one from Sofia from Portugal. How can we deal with bad choices without feeling guilty and depressed? Thank you. So how can you deal with your own bad choices without feeling bad about it? And of course, that is very similar to what I was saying before, right? When you understand how conditioned we are in the things that we do, the more you understand that it is not really you making those choices, it is the conditioning from the past that makes those choices, the more you understand that, the more easy it is to forgive yourself. You know what it's like. I think everybody really wants to be kind, right? Because we know that kindness brings happiness back to us. It's very hard to imagine anyone actually wanting to really be nasty. Somehow we want to be kind, I think. And if we don't want to be kind, it's because we are desperate in a certain way. So because we want to be kind, but we can't do it, it means that the conditioning is overriding our ability to choose. And this is really what is happening all the time. So remember that. Have that compassion for yourself. Forgive yourself. In many ways, you are like a robot. You're running on a program that was written a long, long, long time ago, through many, many lifetimes, and is still being written now, right? Hopefully now you're writing a better program, a program which includes more good choices rather than the bad ones. But in the past, you have written bad programs as well. So now is our opportunity to rewrite that program on which we run, which basically means that we change our habits. We start to look at the world in a different way. So this is really what you have to do. And remember that you are conditioned. And instead of being depressed and sad about your bad choices, try to look at your life in the long run and see how you have changed as a person, right? This is one of the things that I find so hopeful in my own life when I look back at what I was like, right, when I was a teenager or whatever, and I look at myself now and think, gee, I've gone a long way here. I was in And I think this is true for so many of us, especially when you practice this path. I've been a Buddhist monk now for over 20 years. And when I look at those 20 years, I find a vast change in the way I think about things, the way I think about other people, the time, the understanding and time I have for other people, regardless of who they are, right? And start, look back on your life and look at those positive changes. See if you're heading in the right direction. One of the problems is that we often tend to judge ourselves and what we are now. And now we can always find fault with ourselves. There's always problems. There's always things that are, you know, can be improved. So sometimes instead of looking at what can be improved, look at what you have done already. Look at where you have already gone. Look at how you have changed. Perhaps now you're keeping the five precepts. If you are not, then on the 7th of May at 4:30 p.m. you have the chance, right? And that means you will feel happy about things afterwards if you do that. Because you will say, hooray, I've done the right thing. I'm practicing in the right way. Making the right aim, the right purpose in life. So try to see that. Try to understand this idea of conditioning. And it is certainly what the Buddha said. So if you have a bit of confidence and faith in the Buddha's teachings, then take it on board, just on trust if you can as well, right? The Buddha says, the sankharas, which are basically the word used for the will in the suttas, you cannot have it of those sankharas, you cannot have it of choice, be like this or be like that. No, why? Because they are conditioned. In this way, let go, forgive. Forgive yourself, forgive others. When you forgive others, it's easy to forgive yourself. When you forgive yourself, it's easy to forgive others. These things go together. Never be hard on other people, right? Always see the good side of them. Always forgive, regardless how difficult it is. Only then can you move forward on the Buddhist path. If you ever have any anger or negativity towards anyone, it's going to hinder you in your meditation practice. So please don't feel guilty or depressed. Look at all the good qualities in your life as well, and then, whoa, you'll be doing really well. Okay, the second one is from Paul in the UK. Is will and intention the same thing in the Buddhist teaching? Also, how can we divert from conditioned responses to situations, emotions that often come up, such as anger from the same trigger? Is will and intention the same thing? They are basically the same thing, right? Will and intention, they come from something deeper, what we call motivation. We are motivated to act, we are motivated to choose, right? So for example, if you have a certain desire inside of you, you want something or you need something, then the choice comes up and you make a choice about things because of that desire is there. The will comes up together with a choice. When you will and you intend to achieve a certain result, these things are all very closely linked to each other. So how can we divert from these conditioned responses? And this is, I think, a very important question. It's quite similar to the previous one in many ways. We tend to have very strong habits in our life, very strong ingrained ways of doing things. And this is what makes it often difficult to change, right? Precisely because those habits are so ingrained. So what we have to do is we have to learn to look at that situation in a different way again and again and again. Very often the biggest problem in life is other people, right? Other people is a very, very big problem in life. And because other people is a very big problem and anger often arises in that connection, we have to learn to look at other people in a different way. So you learn to look at other people, to see the good qualities in those other people. Right? And very often, if you are a Buddhist and you live, you have other Buddhist people around you, there are so many good qualities to see there among people who are sincerely practicing Buddhist. So focus on those. Don't forget those good qualities. Right? This is the first thing. And focus on those again and again and again. And as you do that, that will grow in your mind and that will become what you see in those people. At the same time, use what I just said before about forgiveness and letting go and having compassion on other people. Remember that they are conditioned, right? They are running on a program, running on certain habits that have been there, are very deeply ingrained in the mind. Remember how difficult it is to change your own habits, right? And if you remember how difficult it is to change your own habits, you can have far more compassion on other people because they are in exactly the same boat as you are. So it's a gradual process. Reflect on these things again and again and again. And as you do so, as you keep on practicing this way, you will be able to overcome even the most ingrained of habits. Okay, next one is from Jack from Ireland. How do we give rise to right effort if we don't have free will? That is because right effort comes from reading the word of the Buddha, right? The Buddha says, this is what you do, and then you do things accordingly. The Buddha says, you sit down, cross your legs, you watch the breath, so you do that, and the results come as a consequence of that. The Buddha says, be kind to other people, so the right effort arises, I will be kind to other people. It is a conditioning process. The will may not be free, but the will is there. The will still gives rise to the right effort and the practicing in the right way. So there is will, it's just that it is a conditioned will rather than a free will. But the choice and the will is still there. Okay, last one. This is James from Melbourne. Are you saying that free will is compatible with determinism? Okay, so the idea of determinism is that things are determined, things go according to a certain way in the world, and determinism itself is a very complex subject. I'm certainly no expert in this becomes like very philosophical now, but there are different ways of looking at the determinism. One is just that the world runs according to a certain clockwork, right? There is a physical universe, and that physical universe runs according to a certain clockwork, and it doesn't matter what we do. Our effort, our intentions, our choices are irrelevant. And it's a bit like some of those Christian sects that you had in after the Middle Ages, Calvinism and something like that. Everyone was predetermined at birth whether they were going to go to heaven or they're going to go to hell. That was predetermined at birth. Sounds extraordinarily depressive religion, in my opinion, right? And they said the purpose of life was to figure out whether you were determined to go to heaven or go to hell. Right? That was the purpose of life. Whoa, really? That was. But that is one kind of determinism, the idea that the world runs according to the clockwork and human intention has no effect on that clockwork, how the world works, if you like. But Buddhism is very different from that. In Buddhism, intention and choice does have an effect, right? What we do in our life, how we experience things, is very much determined by the kind of choices and intentions that we have. So you could say, perhaps, that in Buddhism, there is a very high degree of determinism. Whether it's 100%, I'm not sure. But choice and will is included within that deterministic universe. It is not outside of it. It is part of it. In other words, choice and will is determined by other conditions. And choice and will itself has a determining factor on other things. So it's part of a bigger deterministic picture. So these are kind of subtle differences in the ideas of determinism. Again, whether it is 100% deterministic or not is not really, is very hard to know. In my opinion, it may well be that way, but whether it is really is that way, is other people would disagree with that. Okay, so there you are. That is all for tonight. So let us just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sanghang Namami.